Thank you, Father Hansen, and also Father Welsh, for your welcomes to us all. I quote, "Church going has declined steadily and rapidly. This being a free and honest age, people no longer attend that which they do not like." Only the turn of phrase hints that the words were not spoken this year. In fact, they were uttered 100 years ago by Percy Dearmer, the noted English liturgist and hymnologist who was then visiting professor at the Berkeley Divinity School, then in Middletown, Connecticut, not in New Haven. And in this lecture, I want to consider Dearmer, of course, one of the most influential figures of the Catholic movement in the early to mid-20th century, and hence undoubtedly part of the roots to which the title of this conference alludes. The point of roots, however, is what grows out of them. And so in this lecture, I want to do two things at least. First, to consider Dearmer's American sojourn and its influence and in the context of his own career, and in particular in relation to that visit that he undertook in what was a short 1918 to 19 academic year at Berkeley Divinity School. And this, of course, is still the long anniversary, as it were, in 2019 of that 1918 to 19 academic year. So Percy's centenary sits alongside the Advent's 175th anniversary as another time to commemorate. And I want also then to engage in a little Dearmerite reflection, and you'll have to judge for yourselves how well I can channel Percy in terms of his wonderful mixture of florid, opinionated, idiosyncratic, but always challenging and interesting language. I want to engage in a little Dearmerite reflection about the state of the church and the liturgy to conclude, and to ask together with the aid of the ideas and commitments that Percy Dearmer brought to the work of the church and its worship, what now must be done. Let's see, I'm going to point that a little more. Here we go. Dearmer was 51 when he and his second wife, Nan, came to Connecticut. Dearmer's reputation was already, of course, well made by the time of his American trip. His Guide to Ceremonial According to the English Use, the Parson's Handbook, had appeared in 1899, and it was already past its sixth edition. It was being published around the globe, not just in the UK. And his other great work up to that point, as you've already heard, was The English Hymnal, which he edited with Ralph Vaughan Williams, published in 1905. The Parson's Handbook, I suspect, based on Father Hansen's comments and your mutterings at the time, is still well known to many. Whether the English Hymnal is quite as well known is perhaps questionable because of the history of official hymnals in this country, an issue to which I'll return, which perhaps means that the book was less well known by people in the pews, or at least people in the sacristy, as a volume. But its influence in this country is still evident by anyone who looks not only at the indices of the 1940 hymnal, but even at the indices of the hymnal 1982, where the names of Dearmer and of Ralph Vaughan Williams are still preeminent among the sources. Dearmer had come from an artistic family. He'd attended the Westminster School and then its sibling institution, Christ Church, Oxford. While at Oxford, he became a regular attendee at Pusey House. The principal then was Charles Gore. Gore's presence at Pusey House was already the mark of some shifts that were going on within the nascent Catholic movement. His appointment was viewed with disapproval by an older generation of Tractarians for whom he was not sufficiently conservative, either in his sacramental or liturgical practices, nor for that matter in his theology. And some of you will remember that he was at the heart of the Lux Mundi publication, which gave rise to sort of the first of that series of scandals that the Church of England or the Anglican Communion has about every 10 years, when a bishop says things that they're not supposed to think. Dearmer, in fact, became Gore's secretary while he was still a student at Christchurch, and they became strong allies, an alliance, however, that was to be placed under some considerable strain later. Dearmer undertook three curacies, which was not so unusual in that time, although each of these seems to have been somewhat constrained by his extracurricular involvements, if we would call them that. That is to say, his socialist, his intellectual, and his artistic commitments detracted somewhat in the eyes of his training vicars, as the Church of England would now call them, from their efforts to turn him into a well-formed and compliant kind of cleric who might be offered preferment. He was eventually made vicar of St. Mary's Primrose Hill in London in 1901. And this, of course, was already 2 years after the Parson's Handbook had been published. In other words, he published that as a curate. And St. Mary's became the canvas on which his liturgical program that had already been published was to be depicted for the next 15 years. St. Mary's was not the only outlet for the practice of Diemer's liturgical interests. He was among the leading lights of the Alcuin Club, which had been founded in 1897, just a couple of years prior to the publication of the Parson's Handbook. And the Alcuin Club, as some of you will know, which still exists, is sort of an intellectual circle for the publication of works on liturgiology or liturgical science, as Diemer himself refers to it. He himself also founded the Warham Guild for the production of the ornaments necessary to the English use, which of course was the way in which he described his own program for liturgical renewal and practice. The aims of the guild were described as, quote, the making of all the ornaments of the church and of the ministers thereof, according to the standard of the ornaments rubric and under fair conditions of labour. And that last phrase as a qualifier for the whole of that project is crucial to understanding the scope and the ethos of Diemer's liturgical labours. He was, at this point at least, as much or more socialist than ritualist. And he grounded his work for the beauty of ceremonial and music in an integrated sense of how beauty, truth and justice combine as a single whole, all of which have not merely a divine origin but divine character, because God is the source of beauty, truth and justice. And the liturgy must, as far as he was concerned, be both an expression and a source of the Christian's seamless commitment to those ideals. In 1915, he resigned the parish to join an ambulance unit in Serbia. Of course, Britain was at war. He went with his then wife, the novelist and illustrator Mabel. But 1915 was a fateful year. In Serbia, Mabel died of typhoid fever in July in the field hospital where they were both working. She was thus spared, if one can say this, from knowing of the death of their younger son, Christopher, at Gallipoli in October of 1915. A year later, Percy, back in Britain, married Nan, who was to survive him and become his first biographer. And after marrying in London, they went in 1917, not back to the war effort, but first to India, where Percy worked for the YMCAs and lectured in Delhi, and where they received the invitation to come to America. Diemer's American sojourn arose out of his friendship with William Palmer Ladd, whom he had met at a conference in London in 1914. Ladd had been professor of church history at Berkeley Divinity School for a decade already by then, and he was appointed dean in that same 1918 year as these plans were coming to fruition. Diemer became the first in a series of prominent English figures that Ladd brought to Berkeley across the rest of his tenure. Ladd died in 1943. 2 years after Diemer, Geoffrey Anquetil Studdart Kennedy was the second of the English lecturers. Some of you will know him or under the moniker of Woodbine Willie, the extraordinary wartime chaplain and theologian in the trenches, as it were. Ladd and Diemer, described by Nan later in the biography as being kindred spirits. Whether they were really on the same page altogether is debatable, and we'll come back to this. But they certainly shared some negative as well as positive commitments. And they shared, and here I urge you to take in breath, they shared a disdain for the Romanizing wing of Anglo-Catholicism. They both, in fact, avoided the term Anglo-Catholic because at least at that point it had been claimed to a significant extent in the Church of England by those for whom the Church of Rome provided the contemporary models for how the liturgy should be renewed. However, Ladd and Diemer did share positively a concern for liturgical renewal. What that meant for Diemer at the time of his American sojourn is a subject to which I'll return. But they were both also insistent on the fundamental significance of the church's social witness as something that was deeply related to the liturgical agendas that they sought to promulgate in the wider church. So in some analyses, Diemer would certainly be seen as an Anglo-Catholic. I'm treating him as one today, not merely because it gives me the excuse to speak about him in an Anglo-Catholic conference, but I think that because, historically speaking, his influence through the two great works of the early part of his career, the Parson's Handbook and the English Hymnal, certainly make him one of the most influential figures in Anglo-Catholicism, whether or not he actually chose the label. But when we, of course, read in the Parson's Handbook prescriptions for the use of incense and for the appropriate use of vestments, which was still tremendously controversial for many people in the Church of England. Or when we read in the English hymnal, hymns not only which are provided in plain song for the church's year, but also hymns which teach and practice, in fact, the intercession of the saints, then we realise we're dealing with someone who certainly belongs within the purview of Anglo-Catholicism in more than a superficial way, as I think we might generally use the term now. The question of the definition of Anglo-Catholicism may be one to which others return in the course of this conference. I think that we need to admit that there is some need to consider that question. And let me tell you from the front lines that I find that the students who arrive at Berklee Divinity School, who are not either intellectually or liturgically backward, are representative of many Episcopalians who have been taught either by the broader culture of the church or even particularly by their clergy that Anglo-Catholicism means something just like formal or traditional. They think that Rite 1 is more Anglo-Catholic than Rite 2 simply because it uses language which is more archaic. That, in fact, I regard as bizarre. And by that, I don't mean to suggest that Rite 1 might not have a particular kind of a place in the hearts of many Anglo-Catholics. But there is confusion about the question, and yet there was always confusion about the question. That in itself is not new. Some of us, of course, have spoken of two wings of the Catholic revival in Anglicanism, at least when it comes to that generation in which the renewal or change of the ritual of the church became significant, not therefore in the first generation of the Oxford movement itself, but later in the 19th century. On the one hand, there was the Romanizing tendency, which borrowed from the 19th century Roman Catholic use, and to some extent from wider Western medieval usages. But then on the other hand, there was the English, sometimes as we say, serum tendency, which looked to the life of the English church prior to the Reformation. And superficially, these tendencies are still on show in churches which may be represented here in choices such as the use of a Roman cotta versus an English surplice, or Gothic vestments versus Baroque ones and so forth. Often, of course, it's also true we find them thoroughly mixed up through the ways in which successive rectors have veered back and forth between Diemer and Lamburn or Fortescue or whomever else they were reading. Diemer, of course, was the premier advocate in his time, and perhaps for all times, of the English use, quote unquote. And his Parson's Handbook drew substantially on research into English pre-Reformation practices. This is Percy in India, by the way, just prior to his American sojourn. The Parson's Handbook was this great influencer of the English use. And the Auckland Club, of which he was a leading light, was another notable mechanism for the work of reclaiming an English use for an English church. But unlike some others who wove parts of the Serum Missal into the Book of Common Prayer, Diemer's understanding of the English use was quite conservative. It meant making use of the evidence for the ceremonial of the Serum Rite and of the Western usage more generally. But it meant adding that to the ritual, and I'm using the terms ritual and ceremonial in the ways that they were used 100 years ago here, so bear with me. The ritual, in other words, is the text of the liturgy. The ceremonial is the performance of the liturgy. For Diemer, the English use meant adding the ceremonial that could be obtained by historical research to the ritual of the prayer book of 1662 as it stood, rather than interpolating parts of the Serum Rite or of other sources which some of his confreres of the time felt would make the English prayer book more adequate. Now, Diemer was one of those who shared the view, as many then did, that the English prayer book was theologically deficient relative to the Scottish or the American books, for instance, insofar as it had no extended form of the Eucharistic prayer with the use of the epiclesis. But he was, in this respect at least, deeply loyal to the rubrics and to the canons of the English church. His prescriptions for ornaments and ceremonial, both in this work and then through the Warham Guild, were not only in his mind allowed but required by the ornaments rubric of 1559, that is the prescription that the ornaments of the churches should be such as they had been in the second year of King Edward VI, which of course had been a very controversial issue, but in the eyes of many and certainly many of the Catholic wing of the church meant that the use of vestments and the other sorts of ornaments that were described in the Parson's Handbook were actually required by the canons of the English church, even though that church had actually observed in the breach, as it were, for three centuries or so. To that evidence of the Parson's Handbook for how we should assess Diemer in that first part of his career, We should add that the English hymnal, as I mentioned, not only contained plainsong hymns, but also taught in its texts the intercession of the saints, which was a highly controversial matter at the time of publication in 1905. And it was this, in fact, that led to a rift between Dearmer and Gore, who by that time was the bishop, I think, of Worcester still in 1905, but I may be wrong. But Gore, who actually sought to ban the book in his diocese, despite his own Catholic leanings, because he felt it was so divisive to provide the notion that that we should pray, that the saints would pray for us. So in hindsight, I think we would regard Dearmer as a very English sort of Catholic, firmly opposed to what he called Anglo-Romanism. But as we'll see a little more later, Ladd, who became a kind of convergent figure for Dearmer, Ladd the American, came to his liturgical interests not from the same background, but from a kind of latitudinarian New England Episcopalianism, which did not have the same sort of roots in Catholic tradition. Dearmer arrived in the United States in the fall of 2018. His activity here was characteristically vigorous, diverse, forthright, at times idiosyncratic, and clearly highly engaging. He taught at Berkeley. He also spoke at the General Theological Seminary, here in Boston at the Episcopal Theological School, and at the Philadelphia Divinity School, as well as in some parishes, and I haven't yet tracked down which those might have been. If anyone wants to run and look at the parish register of this place for the 1918 and 19 years, I'd be glad. As well as at Smith College and Mount Holyoke College. Probably, I think, from what I can tell, under the auspices of the Intercollegiate Socialist Society, rather than under the auspices of chaplaincy or anything more ecclesial than that. He gave two major lecture series while he was in the United States. The Bolan lectures were given at Philadelphia in January of 1919, and the Page lectures at Berkeley Divinity School in February, shortly before his departure for Britain. The Page lectures were promptly published later that same year as this little book, The Power of the Spirit, and a version of the Bolan lectures was also given later in 1919 at St. Martin in the Fields in London. And the revised lectures with some additional material were then published as The Art of Public Worship. The Page lectures, The Power of the Spirit, provide a characteristically Anglican pneumatology of the time. And by that, I'm almost tempted to add prior to the charismatic movement. That is to say, its focus includes, but does not start with, personal religious experience or the notion that subjectivity is actually the clue to a proper understanding of the Spirit. Dearmer's Spirit is not the Spirit that apparently guides some people to imagine that you should vote for their candidate in Episcopal elections, because of course that's the one the Holy Spirit is telling you to vote for, or to support their resolution at a diocesan convention, because of course surely the Spirit is nudging you in that way. That's quite foreign, I think, not only to Dearmer's conception, but also to what any decent Anglican pneumatology once said and probably ought to say again. Dearmer starts with an insistence on the meaning of paraclete, which he sees as having been rendered insipidly by the shift in the English meaning, the meaning of the English word comforter. Comforter, of course, having come to mean something like consoler, a binder up of wounds, as it were. He goes back to the older meanings of Latin and Greek words to suggest that the Spirit is fundamentally a strengthener, and hence, in part, the title, the power of the Spirit. He discusses in turn the gifts, talents, and fruits of the Spirit. He gives attention to art, politics, and science. In other words, this is a pneumatology which is just as likely to see the work of the Holy Spirit in science and in every endeavor to do with human creativity and in the natural order, and not merely in particular forms of private revelation. A curiosity in this is that it reveals his growing interest in psychic research. A topic which continued to be of interest to him, and which in fact belongs probably in a cultural movement of an upsurge of interest in things like psychic research and in spiritualism and seances in the wake of the war, when there were many people who had experienced loss of dear ones and family members, and this at least became a kind of theme. And I think one of the reasons, in fact, that the Catholic movement of the Church at least won some battles in the war over prayer for the dead at the time, because there was a new kind of pastoral significance to the possibility of prayer for the dead after the experiences of what had taken place in Europe. At least I think that's true in the Church of England, where the 1928 proposed book at least lent in that direction, even though, as you know, it was never properly promulgated. The Bolan lectures, however, the second set of lectures and this second book published out of Diemer's time in America, are, I think, the more interesting and the more substantial of his American products. I say that with deep regret, of course, because it was the Page lectures that were the Berkeley Divinity School ones, and the Bolan lectures were given at the Philadelphia Divinity School, which, as some of you know, is predecessor institution, along with the ETS in Cambridge, of the Episcopal Divinity School. A review of the Art of Public Worship published in The Living Church. I thought I'd better give The Living Church a plug because they're among our partners and sponsors for this. The review published that year by Lester C. Lewis of the Western Theological Seminary. This lecture is rapidly becoming a kind of narrative of the demise and conflagrations of various seminaries in the Episcopal Church. A review published by Lester Lewis, who was, by the way, in that same year, one of the founders of the Anglican Theological Review. That's a better story for you, isn't it? He said that the Art of Public Worship was, quote, most simply described as an expansion of the preface to the Parson's Handbook. There is some truth in this insofar as it asserts that we can hear the same voice of the same Percy Diemer who speaks in the Parson's Handbook, but ultimately I think it's a superficial judgment. It misses, and of course I can say this readily with hindsight, which is always an excellent interpretive tool, it misses the changes that Diemer was flagging about his own interests and his own positions at this time. These lectures, I think, amount to the intellectual hinge point between the two great phases of Diemer's ministry and career. What Jane Shaw has called the second Diemer emerges at this point and in these lectures. The Diemer who, while never denying or walking back his commitment to the English use or to the work that had been done at Primrose Hill or to his priorities to do with radical politics, had a different set of priorities for the liturgy and otherwise. There is already a hint of this kind of propping and turning, as it were, in the preface to this book, which is dated, interestingly enough, from a socialist point of view, to May Day 1919. He says, 20 years ago, bear in mind that it was 20 years since the Parson's Handbook had been published that year, 20 years ago, I hoped the clergy would try the experiment of carrying out the services of the prayer book as they stand. Nothing would have strengthened us so much or made us so competent for the revision which now must happen, and that thoroughly and quickly. In other words, he has turned, as it were, away from saying our agenda then was to actually do the prayer book properly. Our agenda now is to participate in a process of necessary liturgical reform. Diemer is always a reformer, but the character and the agenda of reform has, I think, shifted. The book contains the six Bolan lectures, as well as four additional chapters and two notes. Copies of both these books are still available in the usual sort of places online. And this one I really do commend to you as worth reading. The first two lectures are about art and artists. And here we continue the undeniable interest Diemer had in the arts and in beauty itself as integral to worship. In the first chapter, he affirms the divine character and origin of art, and elaborates how liturgy depends on the arts. Christianity, he says, requires beauty just as goodness and truth, not because we like them, but because of their divine origin. At one point he describes, quote, the common worship of God as an art, but more characteristic is his statement that, quote, there cannot be public worship without art. In other words, liturgy requires the attention that should be given to various arts, and by these he means the arts in the broader sense, from architecture to music to embroidery, and that these are necessarily involved in Christian worship. This is not, therefore, so much a call by Diemer to involve art more fully, because he claims that art is unavoidably present in the liturgy, but rather to involve beauty more fully. And this is such an important distinction to make, I think. We cannot avoid the practice of art, he says, but we can avoid beauty just as we can avoid truth. This is one of the things that you should sort of put on your radar as for warning signs when people in the vestry start talking about let's have more art in the church. Diemer would be scathing. Let's have more beauty in the church would be the point. In the second chapter on artists and people, this theme is extended. The aesthetic aspect, he says, the aesthetic aspect is a spiritual aspect. And right art is rooted in God. He laments the lack of emphasis on art in theological education. I felt chastened reading this particular chapter, I have to add, although I'm glad to say that at Yale, through our partnership with the Institute of Sacred Music, we actually have quite a lot of engagement with creative arts, including visual and performing arts more generally. He laments the emphasis on art in theological education as he experienced it, barring, he notes, homiletics, which he acknowledges as a form of oratory and hence of art. But by this he means not what might now be emphasised in some places around learning creativity in liturgy, but actual art. It's important to distinguish between these two things as well, I think. That is, he wishes students not to bring out their own amateurisms and to sort of perform whatever forms of capacity they have for drawing or dancing or singing or playing. Rather, he wants students to be exposed to practicing artists, people who are actually in charge of their own creativity and work in a visible, public, and acknowledged way. He wants students in seminaries to be exposed to practicing artists whose work should then be manifest in the church building and its ornaments. He distinguishes, by the way, and this might be not less comfortable for the Living Church and its business model, he distinguishes artists from anyone who would advertise in the church press. Quote, artists never advertise, unquote. Dearmer simply believes the church should engage the best artists of all kinds rather than those enterprises which have set themselves up to provide ecclesiastical versions of arts in lieu of engaging with the practicing artists in whatever field. And this, I think, is a rather salutary lesson to consider. This includes, by the way, I think, part of his continued commitment to the social principles involved in the manufacture of the accoutrements of worship. So for him, guilds of artisans continue to be the ideal way in which the church should engage with those who make the things that are used in worship or for worship. So there's no sense here of liturgy itself as a form of creativity, because he still retains the view that the ritual, capital R, that is to say the text of the authorised liturgy, has its own integrity and form. Nor is this an emphasis on art as whatever the expressive offering of the parishioners themselves might be. Liturgy is not the creative amateur hour of the spiritually minded bourgeoisie. That was my quote, but I thought it was sufficiently Dermerite to offer it to you. In this connection, let me offer the example, not in fact given in The Art of Public Worship, but from the story of how the English hymnal came into being, which I think helps us to understand what Dearmer's point was. This, of course, was Dearmer's great collaboration with Vaughan Williams. But Vaughan Williams, you see, was no, quote, church musician, unquote. And he himself, Williams that is, recounted how this collaboration came about later. Quote, "It must have been in 1904 that I was sitting in my study in Barton Street, Westminster, when a cab drove up to the door and Mr. Dearmer was announced. I just knew his name vaguely as a parson who invited tramps to sleep in his drawing room. But he had not come to see me about tramps. He went straight to the point and asked me to edit the music of a hymn book." That's to say, this is a perfect example of Dearmer deciding that when the church needed a form of art, that what he should do is identify the greatest possible artist with whom he could collaborate and seek to engage that person in this work. And of course, the quality and character of the English hymnal, I think, in its own time, I think is without parallel as a great work and collection of hymnody, even though times, of course, change. In the third lecture of the Boland series on ritual, and again, ritual in the traditional sense of the term, the service and its text, not the ceremonial, Dearmer takes particular aim at the mediocrity of words which had been generated when recent opportunity had been given for new language to be minted in the liturgy, such as, for instance, in occasional services that were offered during the war, but above all in the text of hymnody. So for this purpose, at least, he considers the text of hymnody to be part of ritual insofar as it's part of the language used in worship. There are, he says, four factors in ritual that demand chief consideration. So there's a lot of factors. First, the scholarly emphasis on continuity and precedent, to which he nods but then basically moves on. In other words, he is acknowledging first and foremost what he otherwise refers to as liturgical science as a significant factor in determining how the liturgy should change. Secondly, beauty. And here he claims readily the English, both of the prayer book as he knew it and of the Bible as he knew it, the versions then in use, as, quote, a supreme form of art. Hymns, he notes, quote, make it possible to keep our worship in touch with the age. They make change and movement easier. They open our doors to new thought, fresh emotions in music. Yet he marvels, as do other Anglicans from elsewhere, I might add even today, I'm speaking as one of them, he marvels that the free democracy of the United States had thus taken upon itself the yoke of an official hymnal. This, of course, is something the Church of England has never done. He is highly critical, to the point of clearly embarrassing a few people at the time, he is highly critical of the recently published 1916 hymnal, still pretty much fresh off the press. He compares it unfavourably, that is to say, both this hymnal and the 1861 version of Hymns Ancient and Modern, he condemns to the same dustbin of history. He judges both, quote, blatantly individualistic and weak, unquote. And he marvels at how little improvement was involved in the revision of the 1916 hymnal, but offers, quote, all things are possible to official committees, unquote. Another deep truth of liturgical revision that has stood the test of time, unfortunately. And then another purple passage, quote, the book that results contains nothing that seems new or strange to the oldest member of the committee as he ponders over his nursery reminiscences, unquote. His remedy is uncompromising. This is my favourite part of the whole book. His remedy is uncompromising. Quote, burn your official hymn books then. Refuse to touch the new one. Here is the chance now to break loose. Cut from your hymn lists all that you do not know to be true and believe to be beautiful. I'll come back to that sentiment a little later. His third factor in ritual, which may seem surprising to some but is interesting, is convenience. In fact, he's speaking at a time when those who observed the rubrics felt that they had to recite the expected Sunday services all in sequence without any forms of abbreviation or acknowledgement of redundancy. So matins, litany, and typically the anti-communion were celebrated in succession by the ministers in the church without abbreviation, even of repeated elements, and people found this too long and didn't want to come. Perhaps the most recurring issue in Anglican literature of the time about revision of the prayer book, other than those obvious ones of Catholic doctrine, have to do with how to reverse poor attendances and how our services are overly long and dreary and perhaps too penitential in tone. Now, here Dermer seems to be nodding to ideas that he knew were being formed at that time for prayer book revision on the other side of the Atlantic. But, of course, the two revisions of 1928 had a certain amount in common, even while they had their distinctive features. And in this section of the book, he makes a number of specific proposals about how the offices could be abbreviated to reveal a tighter and clearer structure. A few of these suggestions have subsequent history, even in the revisions of 1928, but some continue to be considered later. It's worth noting, for instance, and I do not know what the actual channel for this form of influence was, but it's worth noting that he suggests in The Art of Public Worship the removal of the last section of the Te Deum, as it was then being published in the 1892 book, to form a separate set of precepts. This is, of course, exactly what the 1979 prayer book did with the Te Deum. His fourth factor in ritual is truth. Here he envisages the necessity of verbal change, considering, for instance, the language of the introduction to the daily offices as they stood, with their highly penitential language, which had to be repeated every week, as if there were some kind of 16th or 17th century altar call going on for people who came to church, having bewailed their manifold sins and wickednesses in ways that were apparently then just going to be repeated during the week in such a way that they would say the exact same thing. He regarded part of the language of the liturgy, at least, as too anthropomorphic in a way that suggests that God is a tyrant whose, quote, wrath and indignation against us has been most justly provoked. And his concern is as much with hypocrisy as it is with an excess of humility. And he quotes approvingly from John Ruskin, who complains that this repetition of begging for mercy, characteristic of the forms of the general confession or the introductions, actually made a mockery of the existentially significant moment of repentance, when a person does actually turn to Christ and seek to change their lives. The fourth lecture is on music and ceremonial. It includes a pithy summary of his whole agenda, Public worship as a whole should consist of ritual at once shortened, purified, and enriched, and of ceremonial which interprets, colours, and enhances the ritual. I'll repeat that. I think I've got it on a slide, but it may have been lost. Public worship as a whole should consist of ritual at once shortened, purified, and enriched, and of ceremonial which interprets, colours, and enhances the ritual. Because I've already addressed some of his comments about hymnody, forgive me for skipping to the sixth and final lecture on, quote, free services, which is a fascinating one. This is particularly interesting coming from the person we know as the author of the Parson's Handbook in particular, as a sympathetic account of Christian gatherings which depart from the form and content of the Book of Common Prayer. That is to say, corporate gatherings held on occasion, but which use forms which, in my language rather than his, have something of the order of the hymn sandwich to them, as it were, an interspersal of hymns and prayers with an address. And he is clear that these should be additional to the offices and sacraments and not alternatives, except insofar, and this is the reason underlying his interest in them, except insofar as some individuals might attend less structured gatherings for whom the prayer book services might be off-putting. So this is a really fascinating outwardly focused moment for someone who was as concerned as we know he was about the proper use of the ritual and ceremonial of the church. In fact, he gives a couple of outlines of services in an appendix to the book that he had regarded as satisfactory forms of free service, but which contain nothing of the prayer book in them. In fact, for him, one of the merit of free services being offered, and again, separate from and completely different in time and often in space to the prayer book offices, one of the advantages of such things was that they kept the regular services intact. So in other words, he was aware perhaps of those within the church who were thinking of a greater kind of flexibility about the performance of the liturgy itself, and by advocating free services as something which could take place on a Sunday afternoon or evening or in weekday evenings in church, and some of the things he has in mind might take only 15 minutes the way he describes them, he has in mind something that will on the one hand provide an outlet for those for whom the prayer book offices don't work, but on the other hand will preserve the prayer book offices from those who would want to mess around with them because they shouldn't be messed with. One of the outlines he gives, a service of prayer in wartime, was a service he had attended at St. Paul's Cathedral here in Boston in 1918, prior to the end of the war. He regarded it as very satisfactory. It had nothing of the prayer book in it. This discussion may be a glimpse of to a time when Anglicans of Catholic leaning could view, perhaps more boldly than some of us, could view exercises which do not rely on the text of the prayer book as events which could complement the life of the church in its formed liturgy. And as an excursus, let me note that while these aren't quite free services, some of you will actually be aware of instances where experimental forms of liturgy are being undertaken in very Catholic circumstances, but which are appealing to different audiences. So, for instance, at Christchurch New Haven, where I am on Sundays when not otherwise engaged, there's a Compline service on Sunday nights, which is a simplified form of Compline, and there are dozens and dozens of Yale undergraduates who will not otherwise darken the door of an Episcopal or any other church, who will come and sit in the dark, smell incense, and listen to the chanting of the Psalms. This isn't quite what Dearman meant by a free service, but I think that there is something to be connected with there about what else it is that the church might do that is not simply doubling down on the liturgy as we love it. After these sets of lectures were given, Dearmer returned to the United Kingdom, but not to a clear future. He was appointed to a new chair in ecclesiastical art at King's College London, and most of his publications for the rest of his life have this as the sort of byline of his books, but it's less well known that he accepted that position in exchange for an honorarium of £100 a year. This was not his career from then on. He took his teaching at King's seriously. He continued it for the rest of his life, but he waited in vain for the preferment that seemed to so many to be his due. And here there began an extraordinary episode that could have been chosen to illustrate the demonstrated interest he had in free services, which is described in the Bolden Lectures. His friend and St. Mary's Primrose Hill parishioner, Maud Royden, was one of the first women who had professed a desire to seek ordination in the Church of England. You can imagine how that went down in the second decade of the 20th century. She had taken a position in order to give an outlet to her desire to preach and minister. Without ever leaving the Church of England, she took a position as an assisting minister in a congregational church in London. When Diarmuid returned from the United States, he suggested to her that she should, quote, start something of her own, unquote. This is Royden's own account of what took place. And they together, with the assistance of Martin Shaw, who had been director of music at Primrose Hill during Diarmuid's time there, they began a project called the Guild House, which was in fact a sort of para-church organisation that met on Sunday afternoons so that it was not clashing with the set offices of the church, but to which people were invited and where they would hear an hour's programme that involved pieces of classical music played by musicians of very high quality, an address by Royden, Bible readings, prayers led by Diarmuid and others. These free services, because Percy's hand was in them, of course, involved music and speech of very high quality. He recruited not only Martin Shaw, but Gustav Holst and the folklorist Cecil Sharp, who both contributed with Shaw to the League of Arts, that was the kind of musical organisation that contributed to the programme that actually took place at the Guild House. The Guild House flourished for over a decade. It often attracted crowds on Sunday afternoons of 500 or more people. Many of them were women, perhaps unsurprisingly, who had not otherwise had the opportunity to see a woman preach or minister. No communion services were ever undertaken. One of the means by which it was being made clear this effort complemented the authorised liturgies of the Church of England, to which Diarmuid and Royden both continued to belong. Diarmuid's other notable and influential achievements in that post-American period are primarily, perhaps, in hymnody again. The publication of the hymnals Songs of Praise in 1925 and of the Oxford Book of Carols in 1928. Both of these publications were collaborations with Vaughan Williams again and now with Martin Shaw, his Primrose Hill colleague. And like the English hymnal, both of these introduced or revived significant compositions which have become familiar to us all. There are a few carol services of the coming weeks which will be free of influence from the Oxford Book of Carols. Diarmuid instituted, in fact, at Berkeley at Divinity School, a carol singing practice while he was visiting and introduced to the student body then music which Ladd later reported was basically otherwise unknown in this continent prior to his visit in 1918 and 19. Songs of Praise was a book, a hymnal less specifically marked by Anglo-Catholicism than the English hymnal, but was wildly popular. It became used very widely in schools as well as churches of different traditions in the UK, and it's really, I think, from the hymnal Songs of Praise that continuing BBC TV series, some of you may be aware of, takes its name. Diarmuid, therefore, has influenced our own practices, at least in this area, in ways that we know and ways that we don't. Sometimes the lines of influence get lost. When the 1982 hymnal was promulgated, the New York Times gave it a write-up and reported, quote, "One of the new hymns was once a best-selling record by Cat Stevens. Morning Has Broken, like the first morning, was popular on the radio in recent years," unquote. But of course, that best-selling record by Cat Stevens had once been a new hymn introduced by Diarmuid's team into the expanded Songs of Praise in 1931 after Martin Shaw had requested a text from Eleanor Fargen. Less seriously mistaken, but still perhaps leaving Diarmuid out of the picture, is the manual, some of you may be aware, Welcome to Church Music and the Hymnal 1982, which points out that Vaughan Williams is represented by more tunes and arrangements in that book than any other composer, but does not mention Diarmuid, whose name also continues to be one of the most featured in the words index. In fact, those of you who have found that the sermon has gone a bit too long and find yourselves thumbing through the index of the hymnal will know this perfectly well. Diarmuid, in fact, withdrew to more conventional territory after a few years at the Guild House, assisting at Holy Trinity Sloane Street until preferment finally did arrive quite late in his life. In 1931, he was appointed a canon of Westminster. And he worked there for 5 years until his sudden death. He maintained his teaching commitments at King's through that time. His life and work was summed up in the preface to Nan's biography of Percy, published in 1940 by the Dean of St. Paul's, W.R. Matthews, who recollected something that Percy had said long before about why he became a Christian. It was because he found the world extremely beautiful, but eminently unsatisfactory. Dhimma's influence in the United States has, of course, been acknowledged as far as the hymnal is concerned, but what about in the liturgy? At Berkeley, Dhimma is reported to have arranged an oratory in one of the Middletown lecture rooms when the winter conditions made the use of the freestanding stone St. Luke's Chapel impractical. This involved, predictably to those of you who know the Parson's Handbook, an English altar with docil and riddle posts and so on. Now, my slides are a bit out of order here. This is the Middletown campus, by the way, now completely gone, and St. Luke's Chapel is visible in the middle there. We'll come back to Ladd. That's my quote. This is a 1960s fundraising brochure from Berkeley, which depicts not that St. Luke's Chapel, but the second St. Luke's Chapel on Sachem Street in New Haven. The acute-eyed will notice that while there are no signs of riddle posts here, there is a docil behind the altar that seems to me to have a kind of Dhimmite feel to it. To my suspicion, even though I don't know that there's really anyone left to tell me, though perhaps that's easier because I can maintain the apocryphal version of the story, is that Dhimma's English altar made it at least as far as New Haven and thus through into the life of Berkeley until perhaps the 70s or 80s, whenever versus populum became the order of the day rather than what we see here. It is hard overall to detect Dhimma's influence, however, in other aspects of the visual manifestation of the Catholic tradition in this country. Now, I'd be glad to be opposed on that observation, but let me just offer one simple test, that English altars are relatively few among the Catholic churches of this place, and that Dhimma would probably have passed out if he'd gone upstairs and seen six candles on the altar and a huge stone reredos behind the table, rather than his notion of that sort of modest, curtained shrine which the altar should be. However, I suggest that Dhimma did have an influence on ritual and ceremonial in this country, which came via a surprising channel and which has not really been recognised. And this, therefore, is my sort of one original historical contribution that I want to suggest today. William Palmer Ladd, the Dean of Berkeley, wrote to Nan Dhimma after his death. He said, "I am sure that Dhimma would be gratified to know that Berkeley is now one of the chief centres of the liturgical movement and of Anglican principles of ceremonial in the church of this country. For this we owe much to him." Now, as William Palmer Ladd's 10th successor, it would be self-serving of me to claim that Berkeley somehow had an ongoing reality as an epicenter of Dhimmite influence, because that isn't quite true. But I think that there is a reality that is more complex, but in which Berkeley plays some part, but William Palmer Ladd, more to the point, plays a very significant part. Ladd would in time become the American leader of a new movement for liturgical renewal that was barely stirring at the time when Dhimma had visited. Ladd, I've already mentioned, was completely unsympathetic to what he conceived of as Anglo-Catholicism and came from a kind of latitudinarian middle-low church background himself. But he was very interested in the liturgical practices of the contemporary Roman Catholic Church as they were emerging through the reform movements in some of the Benedictine European abbeys, such as Maria Lach in Germany. And these, of course, were emphasizing retrieval not of the medieval Western usage, which had informed Percy and that other generation of liturgists, but were rather going back to patristic models as providing the basis for renewal. Earlier this year, because the 1918-19 year was not only the centenary of Dhimma's visit to Berkeley, but the centenary of Ladd's appointment as Dean of Berkeley, we produced the third edition of Ladd's book, Prayer Book Interleaves. Some of you will know it. Some of you, I suspect, and I hope you'll not take this amiss, look as if you might be of such a vintage that it might even have been set for you for seminary study. But this is not because of the original Oxford University Press edition of 1943. It's because of its Seabury reprint in 1957. And it's interesting, in fact, that it was reprinted in that time. A review in the Journal of Religion of Ladd's book of 1957 described it as, quote, a cherished and old friend, which had influenced thousands among the clergy and the laity. And in fact, it is striking to read, as I did, Prayer Book Interleaves and The Art of Public Worship together. They are, in effect, bookends of the emergence of the liturgical movement in this country, I believe. There are many specific proposals and arguments underlying the points that Ladd makes in Prayer Book Interleaves, which in effect became the manifesto of the liturgical movement in its first generation in this country, and the proposals that Dhimma had made or alluded to in The Art of Public Worship. So it is LAD, I suggest, or LAD's incubation of Diemer's influence at Berkeley, which is the channel for the Diemer of the art of public worship to influence the liturgical movement in the United States, just as, of course, the first Diemer, the Diemer of the English hymnal and the Parson's Handbook, was influencing perhaps a whole other set of Episcopalians at the same time. This leads to the curiosity, then, that the American church received the liturgical movement as much or more in its broad church wing as in its high church wing, which is not the case in the Church of England, where the liturgical movement, in effect, became one of the branches of Anglo-Catholicism in its fourth or fifth generation, or whatever we should call it. And the mixed blessings of this difference, I think, become apparent the more we look. Some at the time declared the adoption of the 1979 prayer book as a Catholic victory, even though some more conservative Anglo-Catholics would not have agreed. But nevertheless, I think it's clear why. However, it has since become apparent, has it not, that it is one thing to make the Eucharist the main Sunday celebration. It is another thing to have a substantial doctrine of the sacraments. The widespread and easy adoption of vestments and other accoutrements in the broad church of the Episcopal tradition, things that were once controversial markers of Catholic identity, now often seem to be marks of an interest in tradition and ritual per se, rather than as markers of a strong commitment to a particular understanding of the presence of Christ in the Eucharist, for instance, which was the reason that others resisted them when they were proposed. So, in conclusion, my brief Diemerite musings about where we stand now. What can we make of Diemer's work, and especially the art of public worship, in the light of the present circumstances of the Episcopal Church? I speak, of course, in a time both of uncertainty about the future of the Church, but interestingly, of course, I began with words that suggest that people felt very uncertain about the future of the Church and church attendance 100 years ago as well. That kind of thing is always worth remembering. We've been here before. But not only in that time of uncertainty, but one in which an ill-defined period of experimentation has been declared by the General Convention. The motion that some of you will have seen and others of you need not worry about, but which has declared a kind of open season that no one quite knows what to make of at this point, invites the possibility, and in fact, I think demands the possibility of a further set of reflections about the character of the liturgy, but does not lie in the same kind of substantial dissatisfaction with the character of the liturgy that was true in the first two decades of the 20th century. There are unmet needs in the liturgy of the church today. This is undoubtedly true. The most obvious category of unmet needs in the liturgy of today have to do, I think, with the diversity of the church, including those who are seeking a greater recognition and acknowledgement of the gendered character both of the church itself and of the ways in which we think about God in terms that go beyond traditional patriarchal language. But I think just as strong at the moment in those drives for liturgical change are acknowledgements of the church that we want to be with regard to the diversity of ethnic and racial participation in our work. This, however, does not yet amount to a liturgical agenda which is driven with a measure of scholarly substance in the way that the revisions of the year 1928 were, or the revision of 1979 were. And this is a missing piece which I think constitutes a great risk for the church at the moment, because, and here I'm thinking partly also back to Diemer's comments about art, that the importance of art does not lie on everyone having a go. The importance of art lies in seeking beauty. But it's also true, in ways that he only, I think, acknowledges implicitly, that beauty itself has a culturally specific dimension as well, and that what is beautiful to some is not always beautiful to others. This doesn't mean, I think, a collapse into relativism, but it needs to be acknowledged. So I want to conclude by holding up his three great principles of beauty, truth, and justice as worthy of our thoughts as we consider the practice of the liturgy in the decades that lie ahead of us. As far as beauty is concerned, we may consider both art and music together for a moment, perhaps. I think Diemer's emphasis on beauty itself rather than art as such is something that we need to repeat to ourselves again and again. There is no liturgy without art, but are we actually making the kind of use that Diemer made of Ray Vaughan Williams in the project of the English hymnal? Are we actually seeking out the great practicing artists of our time and asking what they would contribute to beauty in the act of worship? I realise that the character of art 100 years after Diemer's time may make this a harder place to get traction, and yet I think there is an agenda there that needs to be considered. In hymnody, I think Dearmer's thoughts are as needed as much as ever. Burn your official hymnals, I repeat the call. The present hymnal, of course, has great merit as far as hymnals go, but are we not past the age of hymnals? If you go to a church that doesn't have a weekly bulletin in which all the propers are offered, good for you and good for the trees that are not destroyed in the process. But in an era where bulletins are routinely presented with everything needed in them, the lack of innovation in hymnody in our present practice is not so much striking as unpardonable. The generation of excellent music and text that has taken place since 1982 is, of course, offered to us in certain vessels, the supplementary volumes of Wonder, Love and Praise, Voices Found, and Lift Every Voice and Sing Too, all of which have their commendable elements, but all of which, in effect, become Procrustean beds, in which, again, we are trying to sort of put the diversity required in the church music into a volume, when a volume is no longer the medium that will actually deal with the diversity that we need to express. We need a greater variety of expressions of hymnody. I can report from the firing lines that even younger seminarians, and even younger seminarians of strongly Catholic leanings are, this is another taking a breath moment, are often fond of what is called contemporary Christian music. Now, if this mention causes some to shudder, and others may be looking at each other and saying, what is contemporary Christian music? Let me add that if there is much music and many texts in that genre which are unworthy, this was also true of Victorian hymnody. I do believe that there is, for instance, a kind of effective, deep affinity between Catholic liturgy and the genre of plain song, for instance. But Dearmer was one of the first to acknowledge that the possibilities of using service music in a way that was dignified and acknowledged the customs of the Western use was not mutually exclusive with hymnody that involved a variety of popular idioms. Because, of course, the most obvious distinction of the English hymnal and songs of praise beyond the Catholic leaning of the English hymnal was the use of the folk idiom to which both Williams, Dearmer and Shaw were committed. So this should remind us that the criteria for adequate music are less to do with genre than with quality, and that almost any genre of music has its versions of excellence and its versions of mediocrity. And we have been prone to confuse preferences for particular genres with the preferences we must give to beauty in whatever genre we find it. I admire those churches, and of course this requires enormous resources, but I admire those churches such as Christ Church in Charlotte or St. Martin's in Dallas, which run concurrently a very traditional liturgy with organ and choir, while in another building on the other side of a walkway, the praise band is at work with the overhead projector putting things up for the members of the congregation. There is nothing that is alien to Anglican tradition about the praise band. It's not my kind of music either, believe me, but I think we are much too squeamish about these things. Truth. Dearmer only makes brief reference to expertise or what he calls liturgical science in his Boland lectures, but truth is at risk in the current conversations about liturgical revision. Not only do we lack a generation of scholars like those whose work brought around the 1979 prayer book, and here I think in particular of Massey Shepherd, who in effect was William Palmer Ladd's protege and took the agenda of prayer book interleaves into the wider church. This is the genealogy, I think, by the way. Dearmer, Ladd, Shepherd. That's how we get the 1979 prayer book in a short version. You could tweet that one, couldn't you? We lack, however, the collective ecclesial perception at the moment of the significance of scholarship. When we see the groups that are put together to oversee these processes, we see a concern for diversity, which is proper. We don't see the same concern for those who actually have expertise in the history and structure and character of the liturgy itself, and this is a real threat. I don't know that it's a threat that can be solved at the level of the General Convention. It's a threat that can be addressed by the work of living and vibrant Catholic parishes whose commitment to thinking about the liturgy has more dimensions than simply how do we keep things the same. This is not to say that we must not be committed to the maintenance of the traditional forms of Catholic liturgy in all their glory, but again, Percy's notes about free services remind us that there might be a both-and aspect to this. How do we actually continue to have a liturgy that has integrity? Last but not least, justice. Dearmer's career is marked by a constant and I think inspiring insistence that shines through in the Art of Public Worship as it does in many of his other works. A refusal of the ugly, partly because the ugly is usually the product of injustice. the essential character of beauty, justice, and truth come together in the church's commitment to witness to and act in a way that reflects the justice that is the very character of God. Now, we might not think that given the present emphases on many issues of justice in the Episcopal Church, this is really something that I need to push hard. And yet, I actually think we do. I do think that there is a great difference between DMS Christian socialism and what is sometimes called a social gospel, which is, I think you probably know, often means basically translating the character of Christian doctrine into a set of ethical principles, rather than, as it was for Dearmer, living out the deep commitment to a creedal faith in outreach and in solidarity with the poorest. The Catholic wing of the church must make itself the leader in the church's social witness by doing more than posturing about a particular set of issues, imagining that we can squeeze the last bit of juice out of the lemon of Christendom by telling people they should do what we think in this broader American project. The time has come for the Catholic project to actually ask itself how its own life is organized in such a way that says, that acts as if we believed what we say about the presence of God in the poor, about God's call to peace, and about the fragility of the planet. Jesus' moral teacher or inspiring example alone will not give us what we need in order to effect that witness. It is the fundamental belief in the incarnation of God, which we celebrate in Advent, which is the true basis of an effective Christian social witness. I predict that in a couple of generations, those other versions of Christian social witness will simply have withered on the vine, because those of us who bother to come to church will be those of us who believe something. I give Percy the last word in what were the closing words of the Boland lectures. Those well informed may hear, I think, an echo of the spirit of Cranmer in the essay on of ceremonies from the first prayer book. I have no panacea for filling our churches. We shall not fill the churches yet, for the teeth of the children have been set on edge. Some used to think that they could achieve the desired end by increasing the elaboration of their ceremonial. But the level refused to rise, some by diligence in visiting, some by such power of eloquence as is all too rarely found, but the level has refused to rise. A few have become fevered in their disappointment and think now that novel forms of cultus must at last overcome the difference, but the level will still refuse to rise. Yet our course is clear and simple. It is to serve God for his own sake, to serve him in spirit and in truth, to worship him in the beauty of holiness and in the holiness of beauty, to give up all that is unreal and insincere, ugly or depressing, tedious, artificial or mawkish, unsocial, narrow, quarrelsome, not seeking any reward, but because there is a God above us. And in this new way to persevere in a quiet conscience and therefore with consistent principle, without restlessness or impatience, until gradually the people realize the church has some better things for them. We shall not want forever increasing encouragement, but there will be no sudden response, no flocking back into the churches that have been chilled so long. Only if we do what is right for the sake of right, all will come right in the end. Thank you.